welcome. This is Dr. Susan Cobb with Temple of Health Radio Show, and today we're pleased to have Jeremy Taylor, who is the author of The Wisdom of Your Dreams, Using Dreams to Tap into Your Unconscious and Transform Your Life. Jeremy is the author of a number of books on dreaming and the values of spirituality brought out through dreaming. The Living Labyrinth, Universal Themes and Myths, Dreams, and the Symbolism of Waking Life and Dream Work. And he is also a screenwriter and a poet, so that's great. He also leads myth and dream tours around the world, which is part of the place I think he got these fabulous dreams and interpretations of dreams and how dreams actually can help us with our spiritual journey. Welcome, Jeremy. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So it seems like you have been on your spiritual quest for a while now and have discovered the wonderful world of the unconscious that comes to us through the dreams.
Yes, I've been at this for four decades now, and dream work is my own personal prime spiritual practice, and I spend most of my time helping other people figure out more of what their dreams remembered from sleep are pointing to.
I guess we should start out by telling our audience a little bit about what the dream world is and what it isn't, and how best to, increase their memory of their dreams.
Sure. I'm sorry, I thought you said you were going to do that.
No.
Oh, you would like me to do that, yes.
If you would,
okay.
Please.
Certainly. The laboratory evidence is in. There is, in fact, no such thing as a person who doesn't dream. There are many people who say they don't dream, which really amounts to admitting that they have gotten out of the habit of remembering these experiences. So from my point of view, one of the most important things about dreams are that they are universal. Everybody dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Having paid a great deal of attention to the content and meanings and implications of dreams for more than four decades, it's very clear to me, I can't ask anybody to take my word for it, but I know it's true, that dreams speak a universal language. The symbols and metaphors in dreams are fundamentally the same, regardless of the language we speak or the culture we come from or our gender orientations or our passionately held convictions or the lack of them. It's really very exciting. The language of dreams is the longed-for universal language of human communication. It just turns out, ironically, that it's not immediately understandable to the conscious mind.
Right. It requires some study of it.
Well, it requires study certainly helps. But essentially, I believe that every time we remember a dream, it is an opportunity to be more honest with ourselves than we have ever been before, up to that moment. And that the willingness to be honest with oneself is far more important than study and book learning.
Right.
And the dreams themselves, even the worst gut-wrenching, sweat-popping nightmares, come ultimately in the service of health and wholeness. They come to support the dreamer in his or her life.
There's a great story, there's many great stories in your book, but the one about the dragon and the smoker.
Oh, yes.
Would you like to share that one?
Sure.
That is a really important, when it's time for somebody to quit smoking,
Yes.
That's a great way for it to happen.
Yes, the dreams will come. Well, I had a friend, he is still my friend, who was really hooked. And he used to make the joke that he didn't understand why people said quitting smoking was so hard. He would do it three or four times a day.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point he has a dream. I'm going to tell it in the present tense to honor the timeless quality of the dream. He had it many years ago. And in his dream, he is being pursued through this scorched landscape. It's like a desert after a grass fire, and you know, smoke is coming up, and the rocks are scorched. And he's running in terror, pursued by, he doesn't even really know what. And he's so terrified that he doesn't even dare take a moment to look over his shoulder and see what it is that's chasing him. And he runs and runs and runs through the dream, and he suddenly comes to this precipice, this cliff, into a huge gorge, huge canyon that blocks his path. And in desperation, he pauses, is afraid to jump, looks back and sees that he is being pursued by a fire-breathing dragon. And in that moment, he gets lucid. He realizes that his physical body is actually safe asleep in bed and that this is all a dream. And he looks at the dragon, and it reminds him of the beloved old family dog that his family had when he was a kid. And this, it's apparently moving in a sort of way that reminds him of the way the dog moved. And the thing about this dog was that it got very, very old. And arthritic and incontinent and sort of blind. And the family loved the dog so much they just couldn't bring themselves to put him to sleep. Mm-hmm. And he is filled with this wave of love and affection for the dragon because it calls up this memory of his beloved old dog. And at that moment, his vision becomes extremely finely focused, as though he had was looking at it through a single lens reflex and suddenly got it into perfect focus. And he sees that not only is smoke coming out of the dragon's nose and mouth, it's also percolating out from underneath every scale on its body, and it's puffing out the little ear poles in the side of his head. And it's puffing out of the eyelids around the eyes. And everywhere it puffs out, this awful brown-black tar is oozing out also. And in the dream, he's overwhelmed with how horrible it smells. And in that moment, he realizes that this is, in some sense, a joke that his dream is making about his cigarette addiction. Mm-hmm. And he looks at the dragon, and he is revolted by this, the look and the smell, and the thought rises up out of his heart, I don't want to have anything to do with you anymore. And at that moment, he pops awake, and as he described it to me, for the first time in decades, he woke up without the immediate desire to reach and light a cigarette.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary story.
It really is.
And it illustrates so many of the points that are so true about dreams. It is, for instance, a horrible nightmare.
Right.
And yet, when he understands it more deeply, right in the middle of the dream, when he gets lucid, mm-hmm. it becomes very clear that the very horribleness of the nightmare is an effort to increase his motivation to give up smoking.
Right.
That he has to realize how horrible it is, and he has to realize at the same time what the secret attraction for the smoking is. You know, because he's known consciously for decades it's terrible and he shouldn't be doing it, but he keeps on doing it. And I think the moment of recognizing the dragon as somehow the same as the old family dog, and then deciding, even with that thought and feeling fresh in his mind, that he doesn't want to have anything to do with it, that that's why the addiction dissolves in that moment. Mm-hmm. Because most people smoke because there is this sense that the act of smoking is an old friend,
mm-hmm.
that I can light up and take the smoke into my lungs, and suddenly my distressed emotions will be calmed.
Mm-hmm. So that's true.
It is. It's one of the things that nicotine does.
Right.
And until he acknowledged consciously what the secret motivation was
mm-hmm.
for his smoking addiction, he really couldn't let go, because no amount of conscious decision-making was enough.
And what
the dream did was allow him to feel fully his friendship and love for the smoke, and
mm-hmm.
even understanding that, realize, I don't want to have anything to do with you anymore.
Right. And the only other similar thing that actually I experienced, I smoked 20 years and I kept getting messages that I needed to quit. So I went to a psychiatrist who hypnotized me and allowed me to be conscious during the hypnotism. And he raised the skin on the back of my hand and stuck an 18-gauge needle through it. Of course, I didn't feel it.
Right.
And he said, you're only going to bleed out of one side. And he showed me the side and then removed the needle. Only bled out of one side, which is highly unusual.
Uh-huh.
And then he basically said I wouldn't want to smoke again, and I never did.
Wow.
So, you know, that's hypnosis.
Skillful
teaching
guy.
The unconscious. Or
yes.
And then... But this is a wonderful example of a dream state doing the same thing.
Yep.
And so that really ties in with how one of the main themes in your book is that as we are ready for it, we remember repressed dreams
mm-hmm.
and dream topics, because different dreams can deal with the same topic.
That's right.
In different ways. And then when we're ready to consciously accept it, and it is an acceptance more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's an acceptance that we have a dark side, or we have a side that's angry, or we have a side that, you know, is less than what we want it to be.
Right. A side that's needy. Often that's the realization, is how needy I am, and I haven't wanted to admit it.
Right. So anything we repress consciously, according to your book, we often project it onto others, and you use racism as an example.
Absolutely. Yeah, and the only emendation I would offer to that is that I don't think it's often, I think it's always.
Right. I would agree, too.
Yeah, that when we repress, and it isn't always conscious. It's maybe
it
at the edge of awareness, but it's mm-hmm. not like I look at it and say, oh, I'm going to deny and repress this.
Right.
Because that sort of defeats the purpose.
Yeah, it's true.
The point of repression is I shove it out of the way and I don't think about it and I pretend it's not there.
Exactly.
And we do that unconsciously. It's very important to remember that mm-hmm. repression is not a conscious choice. It's an unconscious process. It's like digesting our food or a wound healing after we've been cut.
And so
we need to become more conscious of what it is that we've repressed.
And sometimes these are old, more instinctual things, too, that are coming to the surface.
Absolutely.
I had the opportunity to watch President Obama on The View, and I was impressed with one of the things he said. He said, it is a natural reptilian brain function to be suspicious of those who are different than you.
Absolutely.
Especially in color.
Yes.
And
yeah,
so
and
you might be dealing with something very primitive that resides within you
uh-huh.
that you want to repress because we're sophisticated than that.
Right. Well, we like to think we are.
We like
anyway.
To think we are. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw that too, and I was also very impressed, because it seems to me increased conscious awareness of how repression works
right.
isn't just a good idea. It's becoming a necessity for species survival.
Right.
We cannot go on this way. As Confucius said more than 1,000 years ago, if we don't change our direction, we're going to end up where we are headed.
That's right. Which doesn't look so rosy.
Which doesn't look so good. And my only disappointment with Obama's comment on The View, I was so pleased that he made it, was that he didn't take the next step to describe what the archetypal drama is.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe...
Maybe he hadn't figured that out yet.
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe hasn't figured it out.
He only got to that realization.
That's
but to share it was very interesting.
Oh, it was very important.
Yeah.
I believe, talk about archetypes of the collective unconscious, symbolic patterns that we all have, regardless of language and all that stuff. All human beings, as near as I can make out, are inherently predisposed to associate the direction up with light and consciousness and goodness,
mm-hmm.
and the direction down with darkness and unconsciousness, stuff we don't know about, and at very least anxiety, and sometimes downright evil.
Yeah, or severe pain.
Or severe pain, yes.
Yeah, severe pain, right.
Yep. So anyone who is trying to become more mature, and
mm-hmm.
hopefully we're all trying to do that one way and another, has to figure out eventually that everything that's tall and bright isn't necessarily good, and everything that's short and dark isn't necessarily bad.
Right.
And anybody who hasn't figured that out yet has absolutely no claim to maturity. Intellectual maturity or emotional maturity or even spiritual maturity.
And there seems to be a new genre of TV shows, The Sopranos, Dexter, and Weeds,
yep.
which show that even serial killers and mafia bosses
and drug dealers
can be very, very good people,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which I think is wonderful.
Oh, because, I do too.
You know, because it's true.
There's yes.
no person is all good and no
Absolutely.
Person is all evil.
And the moment somebody starts to pretend they're all
right.
good, that's when the repression starts.
Yeah, so it's neat that on TV we have such a wonder, and some of these dramas are really, really good.
Yes,
and
I think the three
you
mentioned
are very disturbing.
Superb.
I had an anesthesiologist just completely tear into me because I recommended he watch Jackie,
yeah.
the drug addicted nurse. And
yeah.
oh boy, I mean, that really hit something with him. He did not like that show and told me all about it. You know, I'm in surgery with him, so I.
Right.
but it really did. He didn't like it for
yeah.
whatever reason, you know. And I think it's because he wants the world to be more perfect.
Yeah.
When someone is a nurse, they don't need to be a drug addict. You know,
right.
that drug addicts can't be good nurses.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know. I mean, some of the points he made are true. I mean, I think severely addicted people can't be good nurses. But
Jackie
actually,
certainly managed.
Actually, there's a lot of nurses who are addicted.
Yeah,
you know?
Unfortunately.
And
yeah,
and
there are a whole
addiction.
Bunch of anesthesiologists.
That's
that
right. Exactly. There you go.
And,
so
maybe he knows some. Maybe people he went to school with are in
exactly,
that position.
Yeah, it might be bringing up some stuff. That,
absolutely.
Yeah. And it is, you know, you're right. Nurses and anesthesiologists, way more than surgeons
yep.
or regular doctors
That's
in
right.
their office can become drug addicted
mm-hmm.
just because they have access to the stuff.
That's right. You should
and
put psychiatrists
really
on that list also.
Right. right. Well,
for the same reason. They have prescription writing powers.
Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah. I wanted to mention sometime during the program and get your thoughts on the idea that and there's two aspects to this. One is in the waking state, that much of what comes into our perceptual reality is actually a projection of what we're trying to repress.
Mm-hmm.
So that we get, like Michael Rice's book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? We get the same thing again and again. The woman
That's right.
who marries five husbands and all five are alcoholics,
That's
you know,
right.
that kind of thing.
And chances are daddy was also.
That's right. So we have that the idea that actually what comes to intrude in our reality and make us uncomfortable is something that we need to deal with. And if we don't deal with it once, if we take the geographical solution, like Michael Rice says, and move across the country,
mm-hmm.
you know, it doesn't work, and you reproduce it over there.
That's right. And we do it because it's unconscious. We
right,
don't do
exactly.
it on purpose.
Exactly. And then comparing that with the idea of bardo, which you do a great job in your book of describing.
Oh, thank you.
That bardo is the same thing, except it's after we die.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in this place for, you know, like 40 days or so where we go to whatever we perceive the afterlife to be. And then after that, it starts to crumple, which the movie Inception is an interesting thing about crumpling realities.
Yes.
So maybe we have something like Inception going on in that world, and then we get pursued by all of our demons and dark things that we have repressed. And it is in Bardo that we have to realize, just like we should realize in real life, well, I shouldn't say real life, in this life.
Waking life.
Waking life, thank you. Because real life is probably something totally different.
Yeah. Well, life includes all the stuff we're unconscious of.
There you go. There you go. So in Bardo, it's a very similar thing to waking life, that you need to be able to identify those elements that are presenting to you the opportunity to make what you have repressed manifest, accept it, and incorporate it into, you know, your concept of self.
Yep, absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
So, I guess, I don't know, is there any information that you have that might help one to be able to do that better in waking life through the dream work?
Oh, sure. You know, you're talking to a fanatic, so you're going to get
okay.
the fanatic's answer. And my fanatical answer is that's what the dreams are for.
Uh-huh.
They come to serve our health and wholeness. And the more we pay attention to them, the more we actually make an effort to remember when we wake up and write them down when we have the chance, the more this tremendously valuable information is going to be available to us. And the more the information is available, the more we can take conscious steps to take more responsibility for our lives and have things work out more the way we want them to, instead of falling into these repetitive treadmill relationship dramas, for instance, where I always get attracted to the alcoholic, or I always get attracted to the narcissist, or whoever it is, whatever my Achilles heel in relationship is. And I know, on the basis of my experience, that even those deep unconscious habit patterns that go all the way back to early childhood can in fact be changed. And one of the markers that they're ready to be changed is that I will start dreaming about them. The dreamer will start remembering dreams that are about those issues. And I personally, again, I can't ask anyone to take my word for it. I know on the basis of my experience that it's true. But that's very different from somebody else knowing on the basis of their experience that it's true.
Right.
So I'm always asking people to do dream work so they can figure out and discover for themselves, if I remember a dream about this hopeless, seemingly hopeless pattern in my life, the very fact that I remembered a dream about it means that I'm ready to change. There's stuff I can do about it.
And as your book aptly demonstrates, with the story about dream fragments, you don't really even have to remember the whole dream.
No, no.
One fragment of the dream can lead
to
profound changes.
That's right. And that's, you know, that little fragment remains the skinniest dream fragment I have ever heard. The dreamer wasn't even sure he had dreamed it. Maybe there were some pastel colors in his dreams. That was it. And yet when we worked it in the dream group, it changed his life.
It sure did.
And changed the lives of a lot of the people who were in the group.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the reasons I believe so deeply in this group projective process that I've been teaching for all these years, is that the dreamer is the only one who can say what the deeper meanings and implications of his or her own dreams may be. But in solitude, us dreamers, who are the only ones, will end up being uniquely and selectively blind to what those deeper meanings and implications are.
Mm-hmm.
We need the help of other people imagining our dreams and projecting on them and saying, well, gee, when I imagine this dream, it makes me think of lack of enthusiasm.
Right.
And that turned out to be the key, as you will remember, for that mm-hmm. dream.
Right.
But
it was in seminary school and
that's
really
right.
wasn't into it.
Yep.
His soul didn't want him to go down that path.
His soul did not want, well, it's interesting. His soul did not want him to go down the path of standard off-the-rack ordained ministry.
Right, right.
What happened, I believe, is that his dropping out of seminary made it possible for him to discover his real ministry,
right, exactly.
which he then went on to follow in the streets of San Francisco.
Right,
became a very important figure in the life of the LGBTQ
mm-hmm.
community.
Mm-hmm.
Very important figure with his name in the paper on a regular basis.
Right. Well, that was his path. And
that's right.
And I went to Johns Hopkins for pre-med, and so many of my classmates were there because their parents wanted them to be doctors,
sure.
and they did not want to be doctors.
Yep, and it was just easier to go along with what the parents wanted than to actually do what they wanted.
Well, so many were from such moneyed families,
yes.
that also really, I mean, sometimes when you don't have a lot of money behind, your parents don't push you with the money, you can make better choices.
Yeah, you're freer. Absolutely.
You're freer, yeah. But when all the family's desires along with all that power and money are behind it, it's hard to break free of that because you may be breaking free from the family, in which case you may be on your own.
Yeah, and of course,
if you grew up with a silver spoon in your mouth, that's kind of hard.
Well, it's frightening. People don't think about it that much, but kids who grow up with that kind of privilege, they don't know for sure that they can do it.
No, they don't know.
And they're afraid they can't.
That's right.
And, of course, the more the parents say, well, you'll be a bag lady on the street if you don't do what we tell you to do, then that fear gets played on.
Right.
Many clients that are in that position.
Yeah. I had asked for a dream fragment during my reading of your book because I thought that was a neat idea.
It is.
And so I was kind of in an altered state of consciousness between, different, I go in and out. Like you say, every 45 minutes we have to put our brain at rest. Well, I go into that state really easily.
Right.
And I saw a door opening. It was really neat, just a door opening. And so for me, and I am on the brink of changing my life. I guess, I don't know exactly how it's going to look, but I'm going to be more writing and, more toward the spiritual thing, even if it's still in medicine. And so I took that to mean something of that a door was opening for me into, a different realm of my life. I think, as you know, I turned 56 this last month, so.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. I think we do have sections of our lives, and if we resist them out of fear for not knowing what it's going to look like, that our dreams can come forward to help us through these windows.
Oh, absolutely.
But I think every 7 years or so, there are pretty major changes that occur in the direction of our lives.
Yes. Yes, I believe absolutely that that's true, that that is the case.
I wanted to talk a little bit about lucid dreaming.
Sure.
I have been doing that for many years, and in fact, when one of my spiritual students, his girlfriend stole one of my crystals, it was quite elaborate and important to me personally. And
how unspiritual.
And she denied doing it, but of course we all knew she did.
Yeah.
So George and I went into her dream and told her what would happen if she didn't give it back. And she described George, who she'd never seen before, and me, and gave it back promptly because the consequences weren't going to be real great.
Because she had the dream. Oh, that's fascinating.
So a couple of times when my employees have stolen, I've gone into their dreams and said what would happen to them, and the other employees said, they come in and they're like, they're really pretty.
Right, pretty unnerved.
Pretty unnerved.
Yep, yep, yep.
But people realize it's not that hard to do. It really isn't.
No, it's not. I suspect that many of your listeners are pretty skeptical about that, but let me just say, my experience is you're absolutely right. It's not really that hard to do. That's right. You have to admit to yourself that it can be done,
and
you have to really want to do it. Yeah.
No, it has to be important, too. I mean, you can't
I'm not even sure that's true. I've known some people, exactly, who have done it as sort of a lark.
Yeah. But that's still got passion behind it.
Oh, yes.
You have
to
have the energy of an emotion behind it.
That's
right. Annoyance
will
do just as well as passion.
Yep.
It doesn't
matter
which emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Annoyance creates pretty quickly for me.
That's right, yeah.
When I get annoyed, boy, things start to happen.
yep. And, of course, they don't have to be... Annoyance is a relatively negative emotion. That kind of... dream telepathy can also be fueled by hatred, unfortunately.
It can, yeah. But you know what? I don't think that the people who are filled with hatred are in the mindset to do that sort of thing in general.
Well,
unless
a lot of them aren't.
Studying the dark arts.
Yeah, but some people have natural gifts for the dark arts.
That's true.
And... it's taboo to talk about that stuff in modern industrial society, but you and I both know it's true.
Yeah, it is.
And
some people are very talented.
Yes, unfortunately, they are. And it's important if one is being harassed and attacked by such a person to realize that no one is helpless.
Mm-hmm. There are defensive measures.
There are defensive things that anyone can do. And a lot of people get caught in this very strange bind where they don't want to think about it. It's all superstitious nonsense from their conscious point of view. And yet they know this is happening to them, but they can't bring themselves consciously to defend themselves because that would require them to admit consciously that that's what's going on.
Right.
And so they become perpetual victims.
I had one. He was an engineer. And very left brain.
Yeah,
and I got
him
on his fifth accident. Oh, you know, a surgeon in the in the ERs, and I got him where he almost chopped off his middle finger.
Oh,
and I was taking care of him, and I looked at him. I said, "Do you know that you have a voodoo spell on you?"
Uh-huh.
And I could see it.
Yeah.
And he said, "No, I don't believe in that." He said,
exactly.
"But my ex-wife does."
Yeah.
I said, well, let me tell you something. You don't have to believe in it in order to have it on you. I said,
that's
would you like
right.
me to remove it? And he said, yeah. I said, okay. So I removed it.
And you were able to do that?
Oh, yeah. And
oh,
then he
good
came
for
back.
You.
He came back about 3 months later and wanted to take me out to lunch to thank me because he realized he'd had some confirmation from within his family that she had purchased a voodoo spell, which... you know, you can purchase them, evidently.
Oh, yes.
I've never done it, but you can purchase one to be put on somebody.
Yep.
But
yep.
he had had, I think, 5 major accidents within 6 months that, you know.
Terrible.
So he said, even though, he said, I know this is true because my relatives have confirmed it.
Uh-huh.
And he said, and I know that you took it off of me because I haven't had any accidents since. And I said, well.
Good for you.
You know, and it is important for people to understand you don't have to believe in the voodoo spell for it to work.
That's right.
Not
you
necessary.
Don't. You and I, you see, once again, you and I both know that on the basis of our experience.
Right.
And it's very hard to ask other people just to take our word for it. I wouldn't even do it. All you listeners out there, don't take our word for it.
No.
But stay open to the possibility that what we're saying is true.
And you know, I don't see voodoo spells on everybody. I didn't remember. This is the only one I ever removed off anybody, honestly.
So it wasn't
It's not
that you
like
were...
I see a demon behind every tree.
Sure.
I don't. You know,
exactly.
I really don't. I'm pretty, you know, I'm pretty, like, normal.
Right. Well, one of the things that that makes me really curious to hear you say that is, how did you know how to do it? If this was the
I
first
followed
time...
my guidance.
Ah,
the
okay.
The same way. I wanted to tell you, when I have a very, very... Sometimes I do surgeries that have never been done before.
Mm-hmm.
And so often at night, I will dream 5 or 6 different ways
of how I'm going to do it. And
sure.
then when I wake up, I know exactly how I'm going to do it.
Right.
And I think it's great.
Oh,
what a
yes.
great way to determine which way you're going to do something
yes.
and to do it in the dream world.
Indeed.
And then you've got a lot more confidence going in that what
mm-hmm.
you're going to do is going to work.
Mm-hmm. You know, I suspect, obviously I can't prove it, but I suspect very strongly that what you're talking about is how us human beings figured out how to do all these really strange, complicated things that would be very hard to come on accidentally. Like,
oh, I agree.
Like leaching acorns so that they aren't poisonous anymore, the way the
mm-hmm.
Miwok Indians did. I mean, you have to do this elaborate process.
Right.
You just eat the acorns, they'll poison you.
Right.
But these acorn-gathering societies figured out these elaborate procedures, leach procedures,
mm-hmm.
to take the poison out and to use the nutrients that were there. And the procedures are so elaborate, it seems to me that the kind of process that you're describing about the surgeries
mm-hmm. yeah.
is the most
it, yeah,
likely
the
thing.
Pretty, in, you know, there's a lot of different elements to it.
That's
it's
right.
Like it would be with the acorns.
And one of the things I find so exciting about hearing that is that it means we're still in that fresh beginning of the world place. There are things that we can learn to do that have never been done before.
Right.
And we don't have to find them by bloody trial and error.
Mm-hmm.
We can open ourselves to guidance, particularly in the dream world, and find creative solutions to problems that don't seem to have any solutions at all from a rational left brain point of view.
I have a great idea for you. You want to hear it?
Sure.
I just watched a YouTube video on David Blaine. Do you know about him? He's
no,
a guy
I don't think I
held
do.
His, well, go look at his YouTube thing about how he held his breath for 17 minutes on Oprah.
Oh, my.
But he would benefit tremendously from working with you in the dream world.
Ah, okay.
Because this guy, for a living, will take something impossible and then do it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't know how much he's tapping into the information coming out of the unconscious.
Well, he has to be tapping into it to some extent, but
he
perhaps
does,
he
but
doesn't
also,
know that that's what he's doing.
Right, but maybe he could do it more directly.
Yeah, indeed.
But
indeed.
This is what the guy does for a living. And anyway, just take a look at the video.
I
he
will,
held his
thank
breath
you.
For 17 minutes and 4 seconds on Oprah.
Wow, and he's what? He's like underwater while he's doing
it? Yeah, underwater.
That?
Right.
Wow. So he proves that he's doing it.
Yeah. But
oh,
his whole thing about how he did it is well worth watching.
Absolutely. David Blaine.
David Blaine, yeah.
Okay.
I think it's B-L-I-N-E.
Okay.
No, B-L-A-I-N-E. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a magician.
Sounds
but,
like
he
it.
He does things like levitating and
yeah.
things that are, you know, would appear impossible.
Right.
And,
right.
I mean, the way he didn't use any trickery to hold his breath for 17 minutes. He actually
yeah.
held his breath for 17 minutes.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's like, TV. No. It's hard to tell. Maybe it'd probably be hard to tell if
it
you're
wasn't
right there
an illusion.
In the studio audience. Yeah, I'm saying that the world of illusion is very smooth.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't want to say that seeing is believing, because that's how the illusionists always work.
Right,
you know.
Right. Well, he explains how he does it, and physiologically.
Yeah.
He worked with doctors to do it.
Yep, yep, yep.
You know, he used other methods that other people have used. And
right.
The world's record was 13 minutes or so, or 4.
Wow.
And then when David announced that he was going to do this, they went and broke their own records, pushing
yeah.
it up to 13
right.
minutes, no, 14, well, 13
yep.
minutes and something.
Yep.
So he.
Yeah, well, I know that the free divers do that a lot.
Right,
also.
Yeah, he talks about them, yeah.
Yep,
yeah.
yep, they are the community of breath holders that I'm aware
right.
of, and they do extraordinary things.
Well,
but, of course, they've been training themselves to
yeah.
do it for their whole lives.
Yeah, well, that's what
lives.
He did. He trained,
yeah.
that's
yeah.
right. That's right. Like Houdini, he was fascinated with what Houdini did too.
Yep.
Because Houdini
yep.
started the whole thing, I think.
Oh,
yeah.
Poor Houdini.
Yeah.
Got caught in a moment when he wasn't prepared.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Got to be prepared if you're going to do that magic stuff.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about recurring dreams. I
sure.
had an interesting dream when I was younger. I don't think I've had it since my teenage years, but I had it a number of times.
And this is before Monty Python came out, and this is before Jimmy Carter had his incident with the rabbit.
Right.
I'd be walking through a jungle or something like a jungle, and a rabbit would lunge and go for my neck.
Wow.
I know. And later on, I read some articles about things that go for your neck, and evidently that's like a real primal old, it's like a vulnerability thing.
Yeah, yeah, it's
but a rabbit,
an instinctive predator move.
And then when I saw Monty Python and the Flying Circus,
yeah.
gets attacked by the rabbit, it was so funny.
Yes, well, indeed.
So it must be in the universal archetypal.
Oh, it is. It is. I
well,
think it is.
Well, what's it mean?
Well, that's a very interesting question. My experience convinces me that it's your dream and only you can say whether your particular dream means this or not, but all over the world, in non-technological cultures, it is believed that if one is attacked in the dream world and bitten, but is not killed in the process?
No one killed.
Yeah, and my guess would be that it didn't even draw blood.
No.
Is that
it just
right?
It was just the lunging.
Yeah, it was just indeed the
lunging.
The lunging and the chomping.
It was a rabbit.
Yeah, but well, see, in these non-technological cultures, you know, all the way from the Arctic Circle to Terra del Fuego and everything in between, dreams and visions that have that element in them, being attacked and bitten but not drawing blood and not dying, are understood to be dreams about the dreamer or the visionary being called to whatever the name is for shamanic healing work in that culture.
Isn't that interesting? Maybe that's why I know how to remove a voodoo spell.
It may indeed be why.
And my favorite animal ever was a black panther.
So that's quite an ally.
Other people
have
said that the animus for a healer is a black panther.
Yeah, well, in many societies it is. I'm just thinking about the rabbits. I mean, one of the things about rabbits is that they're everywhere.
Right.
That they, in some sense, they're like human beings that way. They have learned to survive in this immensely wide range of ecosystems.
Right.
So at one level, to have rabbit as an ally, as a spirit ally, which if this were my dream, that's what I would think was going on. And this is a serious spirit ally. This spirit ally is going for my lifeblood, going for the jugular vein, going for my neck. This is an ally saying, you better take me on. I want you to work for me, and I will willing to work for you in exchange. And because the rabbits are everywhere and it's very hard to keep rabbits out of anything that you don't want them to get into in the waking world, they are pests of a high order
right.
if you're an agriculturalist. Yeah. They stand for the ability to see everywhere and understand folks' secrets. The great big ears have that implication, too, that rabbits hear everything.
So that might be spiritual hearing, which...
Absolutely,
You know, I'm writing a book on spiritual medicine.
Yeah, clairaudience.
Clairaudience, yeah.
The rabbit has been the animal patron, the animal spirit patron of clairaudience since always.
And that's been a big part of my life.
Well, I'm not surprised, having heard the dream.
Yeah.
Quick aside on that, I spend a lot of time teaching at the Graduate Theological Union at the University of California at Berkeley. And I have, well, at this point it's up to thousands, but, you know, hundreds per year of theological students coming through my dream classes. And because I've had so much to do with various kinds of spiritual leadership wannabes, I suspect I've heard this dream of the attack by the animal way more often than my colleagues have.
That's probably true. That's
yeah. And one, from my point of view, it's always a little unkind to be amused by other people's distress, but it's still amusing to me. Many of these folks are passionate Christians.
Right, right.
And they have these dreams, and they say, you know, what's this all about? And we go into this long history, way longer than the history of Christianity,
mm-hmm.
about dreams with this metaphor in it, this
right.
algorithm. Having to do with the authenticity of the call to spiritual leadership. And they're very upset because they don't want their call to be coming from the pre-Christian unconscious.
They want Jesus to appear and tell
they
them.
They want Jesus to tell
right,
them that
yeah.
they don't want anybody from the Old Testament
yeah.
even to tell them,
right.
let alone animals.
Right.
But that's how it works. No, that's what I meant about passionate convictions or the lack of them. These archetypal
yeah.
symbols work regardless of what people believe.
Yeah, well, I'm really happy I asked you because I had no idea what that dream meant.
Well, now see, it's your dream and only
right.
you can say if there is an aha of
oh, there
insight.
Is, yeah.
Well, then.
Well, but back there I didn't know.
Sure.
I mean,
sure.
You know,
I mean, like right now when I say that, if there's a sense
yeah.
of, damn, that's probably right,
yeah.
then it's probably right. And it's another example. I mean, you are in superb company having had this dream.
Thank you.
Black Elk had dreams like this,
mm-hmm.
for example. The great Native spiritual leader, Black Elk, Native
yeah,
American leader.
Yeah, he was in a visionary documentary with me.
He was?
I never met him, but I
oh, but the documentarist put you in together.
Yeah,
right,
yeah. Tom
right.
Kenyon, me, Black Elk, and a bunch of other people.
Oh, nice.
It was called Journeys into Consciousness. It was a promo for a TV series that never got made, but it was.
Oh, it's too bad it never
but
got
it, I
made.
Saw Black Elk in it. You know?
Yeah. Well, he had a dream very similar to the one that you're describing.
Hmm.
And many, many healers, I would probably say, I mean, I'm not in a position to prove it, but I would probably say most of the folk who have ended up being healers have had dreams of this kind for thousands of years.
My goodness, isn't that amazing?
Yes, it is.
It really shows the archetype. Well, it's a dream you can't forget, I can tell
That's
you that.
That's right. Yes,
and it was,
indeed.
I think my only recurrent dream that was really recurrent.
You know, uh-huh.
I don't remember any other recurrent dreams. That I've ever
right. Well, how old were you when you first had it?
I was probably 12 or 13.
Wow.
Yeah, with puberty.
I mean, it's not unusual to have it that early, but it's
yeah.
still, it's impressive.
And then I can't remember much after entering medical school at 20, but I think between
right.
that and medical school, it did.
Right.
But I've always had a great trust in whatever it is that is at the core of my being. And I think that whatever it is has always provided me with a lot of really
oh,
good
yes.
guidance and, you know, information,
mm-hmm.
and I know that it will be there after I drop the physical body. And
yep.
you know, I just know. I have a knowing,
yep.
like
yep.
you
yep.
say. And I've always had that.
You're not going to get any argument from me.
So I trust it. And I
sure.
trust it, you know, and I interview the most amazing people on my radio show because I know who to interview.
It would seem so, yes.
It's true.
Well,
it's true.
I'm very pleased to be in that company.
Well, we just think that your work is wonderful.
Thank you.
This is something that anybody can do, too. That's
this
what I
is
like.
Something
you don't
that
have to have
anybody can do. That's
to...
right. That's why I gave you a little bit of resistance about the study piece, because not everybody
uh-huh.
wants to study.
Right.
If you want to study, it's wonderful, and it will help. But you can do this work without studying. You have to work as hard reaching into yourself to find out what's there that you hadn't noticed before. It's not like it's easy, but it doesn't require traditional kinds of book learning and book study. It requires effort, and I think the effort, in my experience anyway, it's always worth putting out.
Mm-hmm.
The benefits of learning more about what's inside me are so much greater than the effort it takes to find out. And if I do it with other people, the effort is multiplied. It's like the Chinese say, many hands make light work.
Yeah.
Well, that's true in the spiritual inquiry world as much as it's true in the digging ditches world.
Oh, it is. It's very important to work with a group, no matter what your spiritual endeavor, because otherwise you can become very, lost, isolated, and not know
it. Yeah, that's right. Or know it and think it's some kind of badge of honor.
Right. Yeah, no, it's good to have everybody else helping you along the way. I think that's part of the journey is to work with others. Really
absolutely,
is.
Yes.
Do you have any online dream interpretation forums or anything?
Oh, there are a couple. You can find a list of them by going to the International Association for the Study of Dreams website. There are a lot of links.
Can you give your link?
Sure. My website is just jeremytaylor.com.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, all small letters all run together, but it's a forgiving gateway. It'll take capitals and spaces and stuff. And I do have a training program. It's called the Marin Institute for Projective Dreamwork. And we have an online forum where practically every day people are posting dreams and commenting on each other's dreams and looking for further insight into the dreams of their clients. And
that's great.
Yeah, it really is. It's a very nice thread. It's a very nice bunch of folks. And they're, you can't just go to that one. You have to join the program
right.
to be in that one. It's a relatively cheap program. On purpose, so that it doesn't
right.
it doesn't just open the world only to rich people who can afford to do it.
Right.
And there are others that are, in fact, open to everyone. I don't remember offhand.
No, they can Google it. I'm sure.
Yeah, but you can Google it, or you can, as I say, you can go to asdreams.org.
Right.
And there's a number of links. The nice thing about that is that those links have been vetted. If you get the link off the asdreams.org site, the chances of running into a pyramid scheme or something like that are very small.
Right.
Because
right.
we've weeded those kinds of things out as best we can.
Yeah. Well, we are coming up to the end of our hour. I really enjoyed our interview.
Indeed. Me too.
Yeah, fun. I've been talking with Jeremy Taylor, The Wisdom of Your Dreams. And
name of my book.
Yeah, right. Wisdom of Your Dreams. And would you give your website one more time?
Yes, it's jeremytaylor.com.
And he's got a program that you can join with instruction on how to explore your dreams and then an online sharing space as well. Next week, we are going to be interviewing David and Linda Freud, who have a book called The Healing Gift. And then in January, Howard Falco, I Am, on the 1st, on the 8th, Beatrice Hunter, Infection Connections, How Short-Term Foodborne Infections Can Lead to Long-Term Health Problems. And then on the 15th, Adam, The Missing Link. I believe that's about a healer. And then on the 22nd, Ingredients, which is a DVD about the food GMO and the food problems that we have in the food industry. Anyway, this is Susan Kalb talking with Jeremy Taylor, the author of The Wisdom of Your Dreams. Please join us next week. Thank you very much.